Good morning, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Jerry Freelander on behalf of the appellant in this case. My view of argument, first I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. There are three issues, and I was focusing on the ownership issue and on the interest issue in my argument. And I have an approach that I think helps deal with this analysis. The problem in this case is the conflict between 43-4, the mandates, and also the language in the form. Now, we also know that the form is defective, and my only comment on that is the form doesn't overwrite the statute. The form is written by a forms committee, and anybody who relies on the forms does so at their peril. I know I, as a lawyer, I would be criticized if I didn't read the statute and follow the statute. That being said, with regard to the interest, one of the cases I had cited in this case was actually a circuit court case written by Justice Whiting, Henry Whiting, when he was on the circuit court in Winchester. And he had cited a couple older cases dealing with the question of interest is due when the debt is due. And I found that language to be compelling. And when the legislators wrote the statute, the mandate in 43-4, they said you're supposed to say when the debt is due or to become due. Then they wrote a form. Now, the form, from my argument point of view, is an option because you can just write a document that complies with 43-4 or you can follow the form, and in the form they use the language.
You said a form. Are you talking about the form in Code Section 43-5?
Yes, I am, sir.
Okay.
But that language didn't use the word date when debt is due. It used the language date when interest would accrue. So what does that mean? So if we ask a couple questions, I think it helps us reconcile it because that's what we're asking the court to do, so that the lawyers, the judges, the title companies, and the banks can understand when people use these forms and they fill them in, what they're really doing. If we say that interest due means the same as the date that the debt is due, then that's a very simple reconciliation of those two disparate provisions. If we ask the question, can the interest be waived? Could they write down zero? We're not claiming interest, which is what they did in this case when they argued it. And I would footnote that comment by observing. Here they are at trial after they filed a lien, after the petition had been filed, saying, you didn't put down the interest, you didn't put down when the debt was due. And they came forward with this argument. I'm just opining that that probably is very fortuitous. And if we agree that interest can be waived, and that is, therefore, a compliance, substantial compliance with 43-4, that allows for great mischief.
43-4 doesn't require interest, does it?
It requires the date when the debt is due.
It's two separate things.
Well, that is the question.
Debt.
Yes, ma'am. The question is, if the mandate is date when debt is due, but the form to comply substantially doesn't say those words, what does the court do? How do the lawyers and the folks who have to deal with this interpret what does this language mean? So if we allow the interpretation that the defense in this case or the lienor saying, well, we're waiving interest, now we've allowed folks to avoid a mandated provision. But if, as defined by Justice Whiting when he was in the circuit court and relying on the cases, if it means date when debt is due, then we require people to put down the interest and to say it means when the debt is due. That way it makes sense and it reconciles the two provisions. Now,
but the form obviously goes a little farther than the statute. And paragraph, the amount claimed, paragraph 2 down there, amount claimed, there's a place where it's a set sum. Paragraph 5, date from which interest on the above amount is claimed. Now, if you don't say the date upon which the interest is claimed, can you be in violation of the form but not in violation of the statute, and consequently the lien is just fine?
I think that you have to put a date.
For the interest?
Well, you have to put a date when the debt is due.
Right.
And there is no date included in the lien at any place. All it is a signed lien and the date of the lien. So if there's an argument that somewhere in that document they've set a date that the debt was due, that would comply. Otherwise, we're rewriting 43-4 through this permitted form. And I don't think the code mandates that we use the form. It just says if you do it, you may do it this way, and if you substantially...
And if you do it this way, it's sufficient.
If you substantially comply.
Correct.
That is the issue. Now, one of the things we don't have in this case, and this will feed into my ownership argument, is there's no right to amend this thing unless you, the lienor, amend it within the time frame of the lien. Otherwise, you don't get to come back, the judge doesn't get to come back, the parties don't get to come back and rewrite it. You either do it right or you don't do it right. And so your issue is, on the interest, if you don't put it down there, is that substantial compliance? Because what you're using the form to do is to make sure you comply with the mandated provisions of 43-4.
Well, was the lienors looking for interest?
Well, they claim that in defense of the petition to invalidate, they were not.
Okay, so they weren't looking or claiming interest. The next question is, if you're in that posture, isn't this presentation of the facts on the form substantial compliance with the intent of the statute?
They didn't say anything because the language for interest wasn't on there. They didn't say we make no claim for interest. They didn't put zero down. There were no words on the form, unfortunately, for them to write that one way or another.
So if they put zero down, it's okay, but if they just say, I'm not answering anything because I'm not asking for interest.
Well, that would not be the argument I would make, Your Honor. My argument would be to reconcile this form with 43-4, you've got to define when interest is due to mean when the debt is due. And that makes it comply. Otherwise, you have two disparate provisions that aren't reconciled.
Help me with the great mischief point, because ordinarily someone can claim interest. Here they've disclaimed interest. That seems like that would be to the good of the debtor or person against whom the debt is claimed. So where's the mischief to you? You don't have to pay interest.
Well, the mischief is this. Lien is filed. If you put down truthfully, which is what the oath is supposed to be, if you say truthfully when that debt was due, and it's before the 90-day period, or you've included things outside the 150-day period, you can petition the court to invalidate the lien. But if they want to avoid a court hearing and drag this all the way through the long proceedings, whether you go through a commissioner in chancery or whether you go to a straight trial, there's great mischief because this lien is not resolved until the end of the case. And if they're telling the truth, which they're supposed to do, then we can find out early on, do we have an early challenge to this, what we believe is the fictitious lien? And that's the issue. And there's the mischief, Your Honor.
But that would go to the debt itself, not necessarily the interest, right?
Well, once we get to trial and we do the discovery and the long, expensive things involved with that, we're going to ferret all those details out. And as you know, in a construction case, it's detailed-oriented. But if we can tell from the lien itself that it's out of time, and I can tell Your Honors, I have had to argue these liens at various times in my practice, and I know that the judges will throw them out if these dates aren't right. And it does happen. And what we want to do is, when you see them, what happened here is, I can't say this was a willful, evil thing, because they used a form that didn't have it on there. But the fact that they didn't have it on there, I think if a lawyer wrote this lien, the lawyer would be criticized for not looking at the statute and doing it right. And I wasn't with the statute. So I want to move on to my ownership, unless I've left some unanswered questions on the interest. One of the interesting things on the ownership interest issue, which is only on the Woodside property, the interest is on both the Woodside and the Tolson. And am going to not argue on the agent issue unless I have a little time left to do that. My view is also some ifs. If I ask some ifs, first off, on the ownership, there's no right to amend this lien out of time. So you either name it, and the question is, when the judge ruled, I see this being omissions. And he wasn't being specific about the ownership or the agency. And the interest was the only one he actually specifically talked about. And I know the common law is, the presumption is, he ruled in favor of AR design on that issue. I'm familiar with that. But if it's substantial compliance, because we don't have misnomers on mechanics liens, we don't have an 8.016 where you can come into court and amend. But if they wrote it, and they wrote the word trustee after Olka Desai, who was the successor trustee, but they just wrote Olka Desai, and that was their complaint. They did not put the word trustee there. So if they did that, that would have been perfect. But if they had said TEE after her name, would that have been substantial compliance? Would that have been a shorthand for trustee? What if they wrote TTEE, which is the way I've seen some of these financial houses put it on their bank, on their statements? Would that have been enough to alert somebody that's a proper, that's a trustee? Would that be substantial compliance? What if they misspelled her name? What if they didn't put her middle initial in? What if they did put her middle initial in?
What about the fact that they named both Ms. Desai and Ms. Desai as the executor of the estate? Why isn't naming her as the executor of the estate sufficient?
Because the estate never owned the property.
Didn't she admit at trial that they did?
Well, that language you saw at Record 100, cited in counsel's brief, was a discussion that took place in May. The decedent died May 7th. There was discussion with the contractors because these two properties were still under construction. But you will see in the transcript, she made it very clear, and I put that page in my brief, and it's skipping my mind right at this moment, but she said the beneficiary is the daughter, and she is the trustee. The deed was dated 2006. The deed was given to Mr. Rouhani, and he testified at record page 8 of the transcript. He received that email, but he didn't pay much attention to the deed. The deed says that it's owned by the trustee at that time, Lexima Desai, the decedent, for her revocable living trust. And that's what the deed says. It's in the record. And then the successor trustee became Olka Desai. So in this capacity, the estate did not own any beneficial or legal interest in the estate, nor did Olka Desai. She couldn't transfer it individually. She couldn't possess it individually. She couldn't do anything with it other than in a fiduciary capacity, which, is, as this court well knows, is only a legal title. The beneficial title is in the daughter only. Now, I know there are cases that if they deemed the daughter as a beneficiary, that probably would have been all right, but they didn't do that. So the issue is not identifying Olka Desai as a trustee. Is that sufficient? Is that substantial compliance?
Can I interrupt you there?
Yes, sir.
As you point out, the trustee, by virtue of being a trustee, has legal title. Why isn't that substantial enough without making it clearer that the capacity in which she appears is trustee?
I answer that this way, Your Honor. Under 8.01.6.3 is a statute that says if you sue someone in the benefit as a fiduciary, you got to identify them, their position, their title, and the nature of the fiduciary relationship. That's not in this code section. It just says owner. If you wanted to transfer title, she could not transfer title individually on behalf of a trust that she's a trustee of. That would not pass. And my argument, therefore, is she's not the owner in her individual capacity.
But correct me if I'm wrong. There are no substantial compliance or substantial conformity statutes that would cure the transfer of title problem, whereas we have a legislative response to a lot of very technical court opinions that basically say, look, if it's not right, but it's close enough and everyone knows what's being said, it's substantial compliance. So doesn't that distinguish the examples you give?
Well, from my point of view, Your Honor, I don't think it is close enough. if Okadasai individually is not the owner of this property, picture that the... Am I interrupting you? I don't mean to.
Go ahead.
Picture that Mr. Rouhani didn't pay attention to the deed he was holding in front of him, did not go check the land records, didn't engage, I assume, counsel to do it right, and he is just recklessly, casually throwing her name down. Now, I don't think that that tells the world that she is the proper owner of the property. And what if the property had been sold and it was in someone else's name at the time? She would not have been the owner. But she never was the owner, and she never, in her individual capacity, and I argue that having some designation that she's the trustee is absolutely essential to properly designating the role she played as the owner of the property. And he was just being casual about it, and I don't think what we want is casualness in these things. Substantial compliance doesn't mean name someone who somehow is casually might be related in some other capacity. I don't think people searching the land records have to check that out. So what they've done now is listed her as an index, and that's every property she may have in her own name is now, this lien is going to show up under that listing as opposed to her name as trustee. I, as a lawyer,
your time has expired. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Marla Diaz. I'm here on behalf of the Appellee AR Design Group Incorporated in this matter. Your Honors have asked a number of questions on these issues that I think do direct us to what the core is of the three problems that have been raised by the appellant. The first of which, and I'll address them if the court approves, in the order that counsel has.
I would like for you to start with the owner, whether the owner has been properly named.
Please. Yes, Your Honor. And I have to disagree with counsel with regard to his belief that you must have the addition of the word trustee in order to accurately identify an owner who is also a trustee. This court has never identified or recognized a trustee as a separate legal entity. It isn't an incorporation. It isn't an LLC. It's not something separate and apart. It is an individual.
But the person named is not the beneficiary of the trust. You said an owner who is also a trustee.
An owner who is also a trustee is not a separate legal entity. It's an individual who is holding property in trust for a beneficiary, but they are the owner of the property, and this court has recognized the owner of the property.
You mean the legal title owner?
Yes, sir.
As opposed
legal
to the beneficiary
title,
interest.
As opposed to an equitable interest in the property. Right. But they're the legal titled owner. But this court has never suggested that in order for that person, that trustee, to own the property, that they need to create a separate entity of themselves as a trustee. They are still themselves. They just now have an obligation to hold the legal title to that property for someone else's benefit. So the suggestion that's being made by counsel is that in order for this lien to have been properly identify the owner, you also have to identify that that individual is serving in a trustee capacity. And nothing in this court's jurisprudence indicates that that is the case. In the broadest case, which is a case from 1943, the court suggested that the phrase trustee doesn't have to be used in order to identify a trustee and the fact that they have the obligations associated with being a trustee. And I would encourage the court to continue with that particular jurisprudence.
But we don't have to go that far here. All we have to say is whether or not it's actually, in fact, that case or not, it's close enough.
That's correct, Ron. I think, and that's my second point, I think you're absolutely right. Because of the substantial compliance provisions in 4315, this lien is close enough because we've done what needed to be done under the statute in order to identify accurately the property. There's no inaccuracies in the memorandum that would justify ignoring the intent here. This court has acknowledged that substantial compliance is intended to make certain that there's no material difference in the position that you're depriving the other party of by virtue of the fact that there is a difference between the literal requirements and what was actually performed. And in this case, there's no material effect on Oka Desai or on the trust by virtue of the fact that the word trustee is left out. This is still a lien that Ms. Desai was on notice of. It's still a lien that is recorded in the index that would accurately identify the trustee of the trust, so that if you tried to run a search on this particular property, this lien would come up, so no third parties are being prejudiced.
So there's not like a separate route for John Doe trustee and John Doe. John Doe's going to show up, whether it's trustee, fiduciary, agent, vice president, or whatever.
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly. There's not a search by trustee. The search is by the name. And if you search the proper name of Oka Desai, regardless of whether you're searching her as a trustee or as an individual, you're still going to come up with that lien, and it's going to show up against the property. So any potential third party is going to have notice of this particular lien. So there's no material difference here, and therefore this is a substantial compliance with the requirements of the statute. So under 4315, we've adequately identified the owner on the Woodside lien, and therefore it's valid.
If I'm interpreting your thinking right, substantial compliance is just a pragmatic thing. You look at the way people respond to these, knowledgeable professionals respond to these, and ask yourself, could they be misled? What is the likelihood of them being misled? And if the answer is no or very little, it's substantial compliance. Is that a proper rephrasing of what you're saying?
I think that's fair, Your Honor, and I think it's consistent with what this court has said substantial compliance is. And the definition of substantial compliance that's been given is that it doesn't material detract from the benefit that the other party would have derived from a literal performance. So in this case, what I'm suggesting is...
So it's a real prejudice test.
It's a real prejudice, exactly. Is there any material difference? Is there any material deprivation that would be suffered if you're not requiring a literal performance of the statute? In this particular case, the fact that Oka Desai doesn't have the word trustee after it, that her name doesn't have trustee after it, doesn't materially affect any outcome. She still had full notice of the lien. Anybody who tried to search the grantor's or grantee's index would have had notice of the lien. So there's no material deprivation that is created by the fact that trustee wasn't reflected after her name.
You would agree with him that Oka Desai as executor of the state is not sufficient?
Your Honor, I think that there's an argument there, and the reason I think there is because she identified herself to AR Design Group as owning this property as the executor of the estate. And at the trial of this matter, she represented that she owned this property as the executor of the estate. And I think at this point she's stopped from now claiming that the lien is improper insofar as it identifies her as owning the property as executor of the estate.
Let me ask a question about the due date. 43.4 requires that there be a due date, and for obvious reasons, as they've alleged in their complaint, whether the lien requested falls within the requisite time period. What is your response to an argument that this does not substantially comply if there is no due date?
Your Honor, I'm going to disagree slightly with the manner in which you characterize the language from 43.4. What it requires is that the lien state the time or time when the amount in controversy is or will be due and payable.
Yes.
In both the form that's provided for in 43.5 and the form that my client filled out, there is language in the affidavit that says the amount due that the claim against that party is due immediately and payable. So that amount is identified in the form as being due and payable. So the time...
I'm sorry, in the form and the affidavit, there's language of due.
Yes, Your Honor. If you take a look at the...
Well, it doesn't say immediately. It says the same is payable as therein stated in the memorandum.
Exactly. So it says... If you look at the affidavit that's signed, it says...
Am I looking at 43.5 or the 15.12?
You're looking at 43.5, Your Honor.
Okay.
In the actual affidavit that's at the bottom of that statutory provision, there's language that says the owner is justly indebted to the claimant in the sum of blank dollars for consideration stated in the memorandum, and the same is payable as therein stated. That language, Your Honor, is the due and payable. this amount.
As therein stated where? I'm sorry.
As therein stated above. So that this particular affidavit is being executed by the agent for the claimant as being the amount that is currently indebted, is justly indebted, and the same is payable as therein stated.
But if you look at the memorandum, it doesn't therein state.
It states the amount of controversy here.
Right, but
it doesn't state a date.
It doesn't state a date, Your Honor, but this affidavit is a dated affidavit that states how much is due.
But so what we're looking for is when it's due.
I understand.
And the language says, and that same is payable as therein stated, seeming to refer to the amount of the money, because nowhere else in here is there a due and payable date.
And, Your Honor, the language in that affidavit says is justly indebted and due and payable. So as of the date that is signed, it is justly indebted and due and payable. And that is, again, Your Honor, this is this particular form, according to 4315, filling out that form means you are in substantial compliance, and that qualifies you as having adequately filed a lien under the statute. Now,
but the timing is also critically important, because the lien is an extra remedy. I mean, you don't lose the debt; you just lose the lien if you miss it.
That's correct.
So, without knowing when it was due, how does the person whose property is subject to the lien know whether you did this in a timely manner?
And, Your Honor, I think that adds a requirement to both 43.4 and 43.5 that doesn't exist. The intention of the lien is not, and there's nowhere in 43.4 where it says there's a requirement that you identify when the work was actually performed and when the materials were actually provided, which is the measure of whether you've timely filed the lien.
That's usually subject to proof later on.
Exactly. But it's not. That's what's essential to prove the timeliness of the lien, not when the amounts became due. When the amounts became due is irrelevant to whether or not the lien is enforceable. So the General Assembly's intent in 43.4 is not to, on the face of the lien, make it apparent whether or not that lien was timely filed. The intent is simply to demonstrate whether or not these amounts are due, or, as it's stated later in the statute, or amounts to later become due, because that sometimes happens if you have retainage amounts or if you have an invoice that's not payable for 30 days after the time you file the lien, you make that apparent in the terms of the lien you filed. But in this case, our claimant indicated that on the date the lien was filed and the affidavit was signed, the amount in controversy indicated was due and payable. And once, that's the time that's required.
Once again, circling back to the other point, it clearly would be better if there were more description, but we don't have to hold for you to win this point that was, in fact, compliance, strict compliance.
That's absolutely true.
We can say, assuming without deciding it is, we'll wait until the next case, but it's substantial enough.
It's substantial enough, and we have filled out the form that was provided. They've provided the information that is required by the statute, and that under the substantial compliance provision, as long as we filled out that 43.5 form.
And your main point is that form implies that, as stated herein, is the date of herein, which is the date of the affidavit.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's absolutely my argument. The last issue, Your Honors, it has to do with regard to the verification form that was signed by the Vice President of AR Design Group and whether or not that meets the requirements. Your Honor, I would start by saying that there is counsel in his brief has made an argument that the statute requires that the lien state that the signatory is acting as the agent. But that's not the requirement.
Well, but even if it did, I'm looking at it, and I think it does say that. If you could start with the idea that the corporation can't act except through officers. Maybe that was sufficient. But even if it wasn't, under the affidavit, it said, do certify that Abbas Rovane, VP, claimant or agent.
That's correct, Your Honor.
He obviously wrote a little line across where somebody else's name could have been, but he wrote it out. So it says claimant or agent.
And indicates he's acting as the vice president. Yeah. Well, and that's my point, and I won't continue arguing if that's a clear one. If there's any other questions...
Let me ask you a question. In that affidavit, where does it say that AR Design is the claimant?
It says that AR Design is the claimant. Actually, on the first page, Your Honor, it indicates that AR Design is the claimant. It specifically, there's a line, and underneath it says who's the claimant, and so it says AR Design is the claimant. And then he signs as the vice president on behalf of the claimant. Well, I see my time is almost up, so unless there's other questions, thank you all very much for your time.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
No, I just want to make sure I answered everything.
All right. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Right.
Can I
have
my rebuttal?
No, your time has expired.
Oh, did I use it all?
Yeah, and then some.
I have some wonderful things.
Call the next case.